Program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jeff Rasmussen, a retired Racine Unified teacher and administrator who currently serves as president of the Racine Area Retired Educators Association, Steve Brown, a retired professor of education leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today, we are going to address a serious subject that has been on all of our minds since the events of August 23rd onward in Kenosha. How do we help our children to understand complicated events, especially violent events? If children witness violence or other trauma, they often carry the experience with them, and it can result in depression, school challenges, and difficulty in relationships. And lately, children around the world are dealing with coronavirus, which has disrupted many of the routines and comforts that might have helped mitigate trauma and also added a new set of concerns. So today we're really fortunate to have three mental health professionals to help us process some of our questions about trauma in children, in our roles as parents, as teachers, as neighbors, and as citizens. So first with us is Debbie Kelly. She is a social work professor at Carthage College and teaches a semester course on the subject of psychological trauma. As a licensed clinical social worker, Debbie has worked for the past 25 years with clients who experience trauma in various settings, including child protective services, domestic violence, homeless health care, and mental health. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you.
Tim Grove has spent the last 25 years in the child welfare system, working with kids, families, communities, and staff to facilitate healing and connection. Tim is part of a St. A team that has trained 60,000 people in trauma-informed care over the past 12 years. Welcome, Tim.
Great to be here, Karen.
And the third guest we have today is Dr. Dominique Pritchett, who is a licensed mental health clinician, consultant, and coach. She is the owner and clinical director at Beloved Wellness Center in Kenosha, a private mental health practice. As a doctor of psychology and licensed clinical social worker, Dr. Dominique has worked in various settings over the past 13 years, serving individuals and families struggling with trauma, race-related trauma, colorism, family conflict, and parentification. Hi, Dr. Dominique. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
So I want to just remind listeners that this is a program that's being recorded from all of our homes over Zoom. And if you've had any Zoom calls in the last couple of months, who hasn't really, you know that occasionally the sound quality might fail a tiny bit. So please be patient with us all as we do this. But it helped us because we were able to get everybody together without having to physically be together. So I want to start with a general question. Please tell our audience, what is trauma and what are the main ways that children are exposed to trauma?
I can start that off, Karen. This is Debbie. So I think our understanding of trauma has actually evolved since the recognition of post-traumatic stress disorder in 1980, which is surprising to many people that that was when the diagnosis first appeared in our diagnostic manual for mental health. And back then it was viewed as trauma largely affecting war veterans. There was a large focus on traumatic events such as assaults, bad car accidents, perhaps even natural disasters. And while we certainly still today believe that those events are examples of trauma, we're learning more and more about conditions that are also traumatizing conditions such as poverty, racism, living through a pandemic, which is harder to define as an event with a beginning, middle, and an end, but just kind of a chronic state of fear that people live in, or a feeling of being unsafe in various environments. And the research is really bearing out. Lead to some very similar brain and body responses that are what we know of as trauma.
Okay, thank you. Dominic, do you have something to add?
I do. Debbie, that was a really good explanation. And I would even add, on top of that, it really starts to impact a person's ability to cope, whether they have hope, purpose, or even meaning sometimes, based on whether the trauma is acute, which is like a single event, a car accident, or a type of assault or something like that, or chronic, where it's repeated time after time. And even let's add bullying, because a lot of children are going through that, lack of resources, food insecurity. And now we can even say internet insecurity can be traumatic in some sense when they cannot thrive in the manner that they can. And that's deeply disturbing. But also the complex trauma, where there's a lot of layers and it's prolonged over a long period of their life. And I definitely see that with my clients. It starts to impact how they form relationships, maybe some personality features that the world may not understand. But a lot of that is deep-rooted trauma.
Great. Thank you for defining that for us. So my next question for everyone is, what are some of the ways that childhood exposure to trauma can affect children and later in life influence their lives as adults? Maybe Tim can start with that one.
Sure. Hi, this is Tim Grove. So one of the seminal studies that documents the answer to this really compelling question is the Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACEs, study. And the sort of crib notes conclusion for that study was, when people experience significant amounts of adversity, abuse, neglect, some of the items that Dr. Pritchett and Debbie have already talked about, not only are there psychological outcomes, mental health outcomes at stake, there are health outcomes at stake. So let me give an example of that. When you count up, looking at, in this case, 10 different adversities, and your score is 4 or higher, compared to someone who counts up 0 adversities, your risk of obesity doubles. When you count up your score of adversity at 4 or higher, your risk of attempting suicide is 12 times what it is someone with a score of 0. And while those are pretty jarring outcomes, that's really just the tip of the iceberg. I think a way to think about this is the potential risk for unmitigated, unsupported, overwhelming adversity is pretty dire. There's a growing body of research taking a look at cardiovascular outcomes related to overwhelming stress and developmental adversity. So suffice it to say, there is a lot at stake in terms of communities helping identify when our kids struggling and how can we see it, respond, and intervene. And the good news, sort of the silver lining on all this, is when we see it and intervene, we can mitigate some of the damage. We can help kids find hope again. We can help kids find purpose and feel a little more safe. And that's what I think is important for listeners to appreciate. And everybody can play a part in that.
Thanks. Does anyone have anything else to add to that question about how childhood exposure to trauma might affect someone later in life?
I guess I would just like to add that the effects are on almost every area of functioning. And, you know, Tim alluded to, you know, some physiological, and all of my students in my trauma class do a follow-up, find a follow-up study to the original ACEs study. And so we're finding greater death rates from lung cancer that you can't just explain by taking up smoking. They higher rates of infertility in women with higher ACE scores, higher rates of infant mortality in mothers with higher ACE scores. But beyond, so there's body processes like hormonal processes and the way that trauma impacts the immune system that we still don't truly understand, but there is something very significant going on. Able to, you know, control impulses, the use of executive functions in the highest brain systems being impacted. So it almost is mind-boggling, I guess, as you look at more and more of the research as to how widespread the impact of chronic adversity can be on all aspects of physical, psychological, emotional, learning.
Go
ahead. That's all right. Go ahead.
I would definitely add, when we look at the population that study was done on, I believe it was 17,000 people started in an obesity clinic. But even when we look at the demographics of that population and what we already know about certain individual differences, such as race, socioeconomic status, that definitely plays a part into a child's upbringing and how trauma impacts them. When we think about what's happening around the world, many children, heck, by the age of 6, they are at an ACE score of 10, you know, so imagine what that is like for them to grow up with an existing score of 10, and they have not fully lived or started their life yet. So with that being said, when we look at disparities with health conditions, we know African Americans have a higher rate of certain health conditions, high blood pressure, heart disease. So that study, my hope is that they just take it a little bit further to make the demographics a little bit more diverse so that we can fully understand the scope of what is an adverse childhood experience and what we can implement in our schools, our colleges, churches, wherever you want to implement this further study in to understand the totality of it.
Thank you.
Karen.
Go ahead.
At risk of piling on, I just want to sort of shout out an amen to Dr. Pritchard's wisdom there. So what we talk to people about is if you can get your arms around the potential impact of overwhelming adversity on kids, the other thing we invite people to do is to start to look at that kid's family 7-8 generations back. And if that family belongs to a group of people who have experienced significant forms of disenfranchisement, enslavement, oppression, et cetera, then how do we characterize and quantify the effects of that? And we would argue you can't really be trauma-informed unless you're also equally sensitive to those contributing dynamics.
Thank you. That's a really important thing to add perspective. So speaking for teachers and future teachers who I interact with quite a lot, what are some of the signs that children have been exposed to trauma in case as a teacher or other adult, maybe a church member or something, maybe don't know the child's history? Or in a lot of cases, children and their families kind of attempt to hide things that have happened within the household. So what are some of the signs that a teacher or other caring adult might look for?
Yeah, I can take an initial pass at this. Traditionally, we kind of categorize signs and symptoms into categories. So one category is what we'd call classic signs and symptoms. And for people who know what veterans struggle with, this is a pretty good filter. So one of them is the event that happened to you gets re-experienced in some way. You could be sitting in a classroom and what the teacher might see is a kid who's spacing out for 10 minutes and then maybe jolts sort of out of being spacing out and is very anxious and very unsettled. The other thing we know about re-experiencing events is they can often occur at night during sleep. So sleep is a big thing to pay attention to and look out for. So the brain and body will hold that memory and then sometimes create a flashback or a nightmare at 2 a.m. that will wake the kid up. So if parents are thinking about, you know, monitoring sleep, seeing if the kid looks tired, and the other classic symptoms that go along with veterans have what we call hypervigilance and startle response. So when you re-experience that traumatic incident that happened to you, you are keenly alert for not having it happen again. And that means you are looking for threat in places most people don't have to look for threat. And so from a teacher's point of view, this might be a kid sitting in a classroom who hears a noise in the hallway, and he has to check it out because he has to clear that noise to make sure it's not a threat to him. And teachers often, frankly, confuse that as a kid with attention problems or concentration issues. And the real opportunity for a reframe there is to think about it through a trauma lens and say, does that explain it a little bit better?
Okay, thank you very much. I need to take a moment just to do a reintroduction. You are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of helping children to process traumatic events is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So let's return to this question. I don't know if either of the other two have something to add to this about what are some signs of trauma in children.
I would definitely add, Timmy did provided a very good explanation on the classic symptoms, you know, things we use to diagnose and educate ourselves on. So it's so important that people know that. But as I'm working with children and how trauma manifests differently in different cultures, you can think about it in so many different ways. So I've learned to process it through unspoken or unseen versus spoken or seen symptoms. And one of the signs or symptoms that really stand out to me is when a child insists, oh, I'm fine, I'm very fine, when a teacher or parent or someone else knows or has evidence that says otherwise, such as there was a fire in my neighborhood or there were rioters outside my house. So when a child has a consistent state of equilibrium, when we know there have been traumatic events, that is one of those unspoken symptoms that can often be missed. And or you can call it just overly resilient. And we think, well, how can being overly resilient be a sign to pay attention for? That means that child is numb to those traumatic experiences that are possibly all too familiar.
Okay, thank you. That really is a good insight. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Can I just add one other thing? So many people have heard of the fight or flight response, which is a biological response to danger that is part of our survival over time as a species when the main predators were lions, tigers, and bears, right? And so our bodies are kind of set up to get into this hyper alert state and preparing ourselves to run away or fight back. When there's a danger, even if it's no longer a lion, tiger, or bear. But many people don't know that it's the fight, flight, or freeze response. So typically, the initial sign of fear, the fight or flight response kicks in. But if those efforts to fight back or run away are ineffective, then the body kind of shuts down as like a last ditch effort at survival. And so oftentimes the kids who are in that shutdown response are the hardest to identify. And unfortunately, they are often the ones that we're most concerned about, because that shutdown response can lead to a lot of very concerning outcomes. So that I just wanted to kind of add that. So you might see responses that are like the acting out, the aggressive, the very anxious responses, but you might also see kids that that need activation in some ways because they're really tuned out. So I just wanted to put in a few words about that as well.
Thanks.
Karen, if I can add one more angle, these behaviors and symptoms have to persist over time. So the metaphor we sometimes teach people, it's kind of like when you stare into the sun, you should have sunspots for a little bit. Exhibit these symptoms temporarily after an incident. We talk about being more concerned when 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months later, these symptoms still persist. So I just want to be mindful for parents and teachers that when kids experience traumatic events, there is a very normal and natural reaction that for many kids will eventually taper away. And we can talk a little bit later about what role support can play and trauma-informed parenting can play, et cetera. But it's really important that people understand that the incident itself does not wholly produce a long-term trauma outcome. The incident is part of the formula, but the outcome generally comes when kids struggle to get the supports they need, when they're misunderstood and sort of adults unintentionally make it worse. And then these symptoms keep persisting 3, 4, 5 months later.
Okay, thanks very much for that. I'm learning so much already. I think we've now heard some things that help us understand what the effects are and why we should be concerned about this. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the treatments that are available? How do we treat trauma in children and help them recover? What are the supports that might make it so that they don't have these, terrible outcomes later on?
When I think of resilience enhancing activities, that you don't necessarily have to be a licensed mental health professional to participate in. Anything that is predictable, controllable to a child, and even mildly stressful is not a bad thing. So we don't necessarily just want to take away like any sense of stress, but we want to build competence in children that have been traumatized. And so we can do that and think about ways to build schools and classrooms and other environments where there's a lot of predictability, where children can make some choices, and where we still challenge them to demonstrate skills.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Whenever we think of someone with trauma, people have a tendency to lean on the professionals. But I like to think the people we work with are the experts of their life. So sometimes listening and paying attention, they can tell you what works for them. So I think that's a great opportunity to identify what are their strengths, what are their coping skills. And coping skills are, in the most basic sense for me, activities, thoughts, whatever they like to do to survive through the day, to survive through the moment. And with kids, it can be a fidget spinner, it can be a stuffed animal, a coping skill can be anything for adults and parents and older people. It could be exercising, reaching out to your support network. But it is so important that families have conversations around what are their family coping skills, what are their individual coping skills that they can activate when they are experiencing stress or traumatic responses. But with my clients, I love play and art therapy. They're very expressive activities. And at my practice, I am offering a girl sewing group called So What, kind of standing up to stress and other challenges. And so to utilize creative expression as a way to cope and manage trauma responses, it gives that child some control of, I can regain control over something I thought I lost. So I love just exploring different things, and they may surprise themselves that they didn't even know things could be a coping skill. So that exploration is so important.
Dr. Pritchett, your energy gives me amazing hope.
Thank you.
So the only other thing I would add to that, Karen, this is Tim Grove again, is the clinical word that's often used is something called rescripting. And that sounds kind of technical, but what it really means is I'm holding the outcome of the bad memory or experience, meaning I'm expecting something bad to happen. Being gears up for that, when adults get into situations where kids are expecting something bad to happen and they can create something good to happen, that's a rescripting moment too. So let me break that down a little more simply. If I'm a parent and I'm struggling with a child who's having sleep issues, and it's been the fourth night in a row of me losing sleep because they're losing sleep, and in the fifth morning, I sort of interact with that kid and I kind of lose my temper. If I can stop in that moment and just acknowledge what's going on and then find a way to reconcile with that child and say, honey, I'm really sorry. This has just been stressful for all of us. But most importantly, it's been really hard for you. Those moments of reconciliation are rescripting moments. And so I just want to make sure that the non-clinicians out there recognize the power they have to be a broader part of the care and treatment planning for kids who are struggling.
Thank you. So another question I have is, and this could be for both parents and teachers and the way they set up their classrooms and the way schools and school maybe discipline is set up. What are the factors that promote resilience in the face of trauma? And does it matter at what age a child has exposure to trauma, for example? I mean, is there something that we as parents or as teachers can do, or perhaps churches or other community organizations?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. And so I think that the fundamental piece in every environment where a traumatized child is that they need to feel safe. So they are not going to be able to start healing if they are in a state where they are not feeling safe, because they have this kind of sensitized stress response system. And so they're going to kind of continue to be in this fight, flight, or freeze response as long as they perceive danger. Now, we might be in a classroom and we say, well, this, of course, it's safe. But if the child has certain unknown triggers or other things going on, like I think Dr. Pritchett had said, bullying or other things going on, just a look across the classroom from somebody that's bullying that child can trigger this entire cascade of events. So the safety in all environments is a critical place to start. And then your question about stages of development is really, really important too, because we know that one of the reasons that children are more vulnerable to trauma is that their brains are still developing. And so traumatic events or conditions impact us differently depending on what areas of our brain are developing. And if there's disruptions in early stages of brain development, subsequent brain centers are not developing properly. So they kind of have to develop in the right order. And so the highest level brain functions that are necessary in a school environment for learning are in our cortical brain. And those are our executive functions like paying attention, learning new material, problem solving, even language centers and things like that are not working as well in children who were traumatized at earlier stages of brain development, like we're in the brainstem and the emotional brain centers, and those are the two that develop prior. And so that's kind of the foundation upon which the learning centers of the brain can develop. And so we have to know that those more primitive brain centers almost need to be more fully developed for children in order for them to access the highest. So I'm getting a little technical here, but like we just really have to understand that some children are going to need things like rocking right? So like in order for a baby's brain to develop, they need to be held and rocked. And so we find that like repetitive back and forth physical activities for kids who experienced early trauma are actually really powerful in helping to rebuild the lower brain areas, which are going to be necessary in order for those higher brain skills to develop.
Wow, that's a lot of information that I didn't know. So thank you. Does anyone else have anything to add to that about factors that promote resilience?
Yeah, I would definitely add. I love hearing Debbie and Tim talk. I wish I could just be in there. Share. But in terms of promoting resilience, I think we have to look at areas that are not conducive for resilience, such as scheduled fire alarms or active shooter drills. Those things are important. However, for a child who is experiencing current trauma or has a history of trauma, a fire alarm can be so dysregulating for them. So being mindful of how these activities that schools have to do are impacting children. So you have to almost go into it expecting that this was not a pleasant experience for a child before you can start promoting resilience. And I think kids deserve that respect to always consider that. Another thing I want to say, children who have a history of trauma are very control sensitive. What that means is that we think they are bullheaded or they are demanding. No, what they're saying is that I don't want you to take over the things I know how to do or take over my life. So we have to give kids an opportunity to demonstrate ownership in their academics, with their friends, and even in therapy treatments. And that's called treatment ownership. And also catch kids coping. You know, if a little so-and-so went over and helped a friend who was scared, those are opportunities to catch coping and promote that resilience that, hey, I saw that. What made you do that? So that child can build on that act of kindness and what they thought was appropriate to help a friend, but also to soothe themselves as well. And the last thing I want to say is children expect adults to keep them safe. If you see a child being bullied and you do not attend to that child, or that child came to you and they said, so-and-so is bullying me, and you say, yeah, they are going to build that connection or lack thereof of attachment with you because you are not being consistent and doing what you said you would do. And that was to promote safety and all the other things that teachers do. They're superheroes. So kids expect consistency from us. And here's a message for the adults. If we cannot fulfill those roles, we have to do the things we need to do to take care of ourselves, because little people, young people are watching and paying attention.
And Karen, if I can just add one other comment on resiliency. A Canadian researcher by the name of Mike Ungar, UNGAR, has done resiliency research around the world. And there are factors that we often don't think of that are quite relevant to the times we live in. So if you think about a survivor of sexual assault and all the difficulty that that survivor is going through, one of the things that's part of both a resiliency process and a healing process is a belief in some form of justice. And justice, I know, is kind of a loaded word these days, but justice sort of presumes a degree of equity or fairness or equitable treatment. So part of what I get questions on quite a bit is, should I let my 14-year-old be part of the protests? And what I often say to that is absolutely, because if that gives them a sense that their activity is contributing to the possibility of equity and justice, that is probably a healing activity for them, for one. But for two, for the rest of the world, when you believe the system might treat you fairly, so think of when it doesn't as a converse to this, it's woven into this trauma discussion. So if I'm sitting there suffering from being assaulted and I don't believe, for sometimes lots of really good reasons, the system will be equitable and fair, that will contribute to my trauma response. So you really can't unpack justice and equity from trauma recovery.
Okay, thank you. So as I predicted, time is flowing right by and we're learning a lot, but I do need to do a reintroduction break and then we're probably only gonna get to a few more questions before our time is up. Maybe we need to meet again at some point. So listeners, you are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters, being recorded from our homes. So if you notice any issues with recording sound or speed, that might be why. This discussion of helping children to process traumatic events is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So I want to focus our next portion of this discussion, because we only have about 8 minutes left, believe it or not, about two big things that are prominent in children's lives, in all our lives lately, and in Kenosha in particular. So one of them is COVID-19, the pandemic, all of the things that have changed during this time, including school being different or unstable or at home. And then of course, in August, many of our children in Kenosha experienced trauma in their own community, either as firsthand witnesses or through media or the conversation of adults around them. So I had a whole lot of parents and mental health professionals compose questions for you about specifically about the events in Kenosha. You all have the questions, but let's just kind of dive in and spend our last 8 minutes in a productive way. So who would like to start on this a little bit?
It is a huge challenge, Karen, right now with all of the limitations brought by the pandemic, because the things that we would normally suggest to families for healing would be relationship and structured activities and keeping routines the same. This has all been kind of thrown out the window, but we have to find creative ways, because those are still the tried and true ways that we know that children and adults heal. So we have to find a way to connect, even if we're physically distant. We have to find a way to give children predictable schedules, even if they're not in a school building right now. And I think we also have to find ways to allow children to take actions that they feel can help others. So it could be as simple as, do you want to make some sandwiches that we can bring to our neighbors in need? Do you want to draw a picture for somebody who might be struggling, to let them know you're thinking about them, and to give children a sense that they can make a difference and that they're not powerless when all of this is going on around them?
Okay. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. We have to look at each situation as a unique situation. However, our feelings and our emotions won't say the same thing, because it's complex and it's compounded. So many individuals have asked about the racial tension in our city, and children have said, are police bad? Can I play with my Black friends? Can my Black friends play with me? I encourage parents and teachers to have real and authentic conversations with your children, which I believe is a significant factor to promoting resilience, healing. I wouldn't be so quick to jump towards restoration or reconciliation, because sometimes we want to get to that portion because we're more comfortable there. So staying with those hard and uncomfortable questions and being okay not to have all the answers. But when we look at COVID and now what happened in August in our city, people had to decide, you know, do I bend some of the restrictions to participate in these healing activities such as protests? I need a physical hug from my friends and family members. So people have had to decide how they want to handle those situations. But I encourage everyone to acknowledge what is happening. We can no longer deny that racism exists. And I'm very to the point, racism is traumatic. And to be silent is violent. So having real authentic conversations with our children because they are exposed to it, being mindful of how we're coping around our children, because again, I will say this on blue in the face, they are watching, but not to the point where you are not being true and real with yourself. I mean, I have so much to say about that in the short time that we have, and I definitely want to give my colleague Tim an opportunity to respond. But there is no easy answer for what we're going through, and you have an opportunity to help define and redefine some of the things maybe you have been teaching your children in your household that if... because it is alive and woke again. Amen.
Does anyone have something to add to that?
I think sometimes parents struggle to know how much to share with their children. And I think that this can really vary. I think it's important for parents to really listen to what children are actually asking and give answers to what the children are asking, and that it's also okay to say, I don't know. And it's really also okay for parents to say, this is really hard for me too, and I don't have all the answers, but we're going to learn together about this. Maybe we're going to go find some books at the library, because maybe as a parent, you don't feel equipped to talk to your children about the Black experience in America. And so it's really okay to say, I'm going to take time to educate myself, and we're going to kind of go through this together. So using resources in the community and admitting that we don't have all the answers, I think is an important first step. And it really models for your children that you're kind of willing to listen and learn from others.
Yeah.
Dr. Pritchett. One thing I would just quickly add on top of that is, if you are in the camp, and I would hope this would be true, that you appreciate sort of the movement around Black Lives Matter, put a sign in your yard. I know it seems like maybe a small token or whatever the case might be, but back to this trauma and justice and equity being sort of interwoven together, the more of those signs that are out there, the more someone who's watching or observing might say, huh, I didn't know that. I wouldn't have thought that in my neighborhood of 20 houses, 12 houses have a sign. Maybe that means at least people are willing to think critically and absorb some of this information. I mean, it's a really simple thing to do. And I wonder how many people are out there who are supportive of the movement and the cause, but maybe haven't taken that step yet. I know when I walk in my suburban neighborhood and I see those signs, it's very heartening for me. And that's from the perspective of a white male. So I can only imagine what it might be for others.
Mm-hmm. When some of my younger clients asked, well, how do I understand what Black Lives Matter means? I'm not talking about the organization. I am talking about those three words, Black Lives Matter. I believe the most simple way and how we can start use it in conversation is, until every life truly matters, certain lives cannot matter over others. And what we know is that a Black life is not valued at the same equivalency as property. And we recently saw that with Breonna Taylor and that whole situation. So until Black lives truly, truly matter, we look at socioeconomic status, health disparities, access to resources, and so many other disparaging differences, until all of those things start to matter. And true justice is really given when it's necessary or when it's needed. All lives can't matter. And to be clear, every life is so important. However, we cannot pick and choose when a life